God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, will not we fear, though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea, though the waters thereof roar and be troubled, though the mountains shake with the swelling thereof, Selah. There is a river, the streams whereof shall make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacles of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God shall help her, and that right early. The heathen raged, the kingdoms were moved. He uttered his voice, the earth melted. Yahweh of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge, Selah. Come, behold the works of Yahweh, what desolations he hath made in the earth. He maketh wars to cease unto the end of the earth. He breaketh the bow and cutteth the spear in sunder. He burneth the chariot in the fire. Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the heathen. I will be exalted in the earth. Yahweh of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Selah. And now we'll turn the class over to our brother, Tech Morgan.
Thank you, Brother Jim. Good evening, everyone. When you look at the city of Jerusalem, there's one thing that draws the eye, isn't there? It's inescapable. Automatically, your eye is drawn towards the Temple Mount and towards the golden dome of the noble sanctuary that's now situated on it. We might think of it as a desolation, as an abomination that makes desolate, but even when you're looking from the Mount of Olives and gazing down across the city, it is the one visual feature that catches the eye. You know, without it, the cityscape would look very different, quite nondescript, in fact. And it must have been when the temple was established in Jerusalem, and Josephus speaks about that temple as being of white stone with golden accessories. He speaks of it as something that naturally drew the eye. So Jerusalem is, well, we know full well, a very special city, a city in which the whole history of God's purpose is marched out. Well, I'm not having snipers again, am I, attacking? I'm sure there's a Jew in the sound system somewhere who's drawing exception, but I'm sure he was pleased when the noble sanctuary disappeared. Of course, all that's left of the temple that once existed, the Herodian temple, is the western or the Wailing Wall. And that's the place that naturally attracts attention. But this was never the wall of the temple. This, remember, was part of the retaining wall of the platform upon which Herod built his temple. And people study and look carefully at those stones. These are the Herodian courses. Those are the Herodian stones. You can tell them from their size and from the way that they've been sculpted. On top of them have come the Arab developments, and beyond them the Crusader developments. So that wall in itself is an indication of the complexity of the archaeology of, well, everywhere, but especially Jerusalem, which is a comparatively small place as far as the old city is concerned, and which has been developed and redeveloped over the centuries. After all, for nearly 2,000 years, it was Gentile feet that trampled this particular city. That's the Wilson's Arch that gives you an access to more of the stones. It was discovered by a man called Charles Wilson. Well, actually, it was discovered by a man called Titus Tobler, who was a Swiss, but Charles Wilson got it named after him. He was a better publicist. It's just as well, in a way, because if it had been known as the Tobler Zone, then we'd probably have ended up with chocolates which were called Wilson Bars. So Charles Wilson then discovered this particular area here, and when you go through there, you can see what was once a retaining arch over which a road ran, which was feeding the Temple Mount as it existed in Herodian times. Now it's a place of prayer. It's a place where The Torah scrolls are reposed in these cupboards here, and where the faithful Orthodox Jews go. You can, of course, hire yourself an entire kit, phylactery and prayer shawl and the lot, if you wish to go on the Temple Mount. And people take exception to you taking photographs if they're deep in meditation. But the Temple Mount itself is carefully studied. Brother Lane Ritmier, who has a blog, has found this particular stone, for example, which he says is quite distinct from the other stones in this particular area. He's called that the smooth stone, and has deduced, though nobody can know for certain, that this might have been one of the stones that was originally part of the colonnade of porticos that surrounded the temple. He thinks not an original stone from the temple, but from the colonnades that were associated with it. So you can see how carefully people survey the scene and look to see what the stones in the temple are like. For the Jew, of course, this is a place where they come to pray. The Orthodox Jew will never go up onto the Temple Mount himself, lest inadvertently he should stray across the Holy of Holies. So they will stay at this particular level, well below the platform. Remember the Herodian platform that was at about this level here? Well, they're some distance away. But there is another western wall tunnel which gives you access to another 1,500 feet of the temple wall. You might remember some years ago there was quite a lot of controversy when it was suggested that tourists might be allowed to go through this tunnel and emerge in the Arab quarters. And the Arabs took exception to the thought of a lot of Gentile and Jewish tourists traipsing through their quarter of Jerusalem, and eventually the Israeli government abandoned that idea. But you can now go, and 150 feet into that tunnel, the Western Wall Tunnel, you'll come to this particular area here, where the Jews had a synagogue for a long period of time, and according to their calculations, and working on the basis of where they think the temple was once established, this, to their mind, was the closest they could conceivably get to the most holy place. They call this the cave synagogue, or the synagogue of the cave. There are some huge stones in this particular tunnel, the Western Wall Tunnel. They reckon that one of the stones here, which is 45 feet long by 10 feet by 11 feet, if you can think of it in cubic terms, which weighed about 570 tons, they reckon that was the biggest stone that was ever moved manually. So there were some huge stones, Herodian stones, remember, when Herod was refurbishing and redeveloping this temple area. Herod wanted it to be the jewel in the crown of Jerusalem, and as such he expended a huge amount of money and effort to beautify and to vastly enlarge the temple area so that his temple could be established there. So the Jews will come and will worship at the Western Wall and will diligently poke their prayers, you can probably see some of them, into the cracks that exist. And then the Jews have a clearing up party that come down on a regular basis to take the prayers out so that there'll be room for other prayers. And they carefully preserve all the prayers that have been rescued. So they must have a huge dossier of prayers somewhere or other. On some of the feast days, just imagine what it's like. This is Sukkot, the Feast of the Tabernacles, and suddenly you can see that everybody's squeezing in there and hoping they can get somewhere near the wall. Some hope, you might think. And all of these would be men, because in fact this is a carefully segregated area, and the women, the Jewish women, have to go into a much smaller area towards the right. It's a place, of course, where bar mitzvahs are celebrated. And a lot of people, a lot of Jews from America, come over to celebrate their bar mitzvah. And it's fascinating because they must spend a huge amount of money in hiring these Torah scrolls. It's all a question of how much money you can afford, a little bit like a wedding, I suppose, in terms of how much are you going to expend on the finest wedding that ever anybody has seen. because some of the other scrolls are rather greater or lesser in terms of size. And you'll notice again, not a woman to be seen, not a Jewish lady to be seen. They're all in their Jewish quarter, in the ladies' quarter, throwing sweets across to celebrate their son's bar mitzvah, and standing on the plastic seats that are there and peering over the dividing wall so that they can see what's going on. So the Jews are maintaining their strict separation. In Orthodox terms, of course, the liberal synagogues are different, but to this day, in an Orthodox synagogue, the men sit in the place of business and the women sit elsewhere. On the Temple Mount itself, there is, of course, a magnificent structure, if you like that sort of thing, probably the finest piece of Islamic architecture that now exists. It was built much later on than Herod's Temple, in 651 AD. 651 AD. So we're much more than 500 years after Herod's Temple. And you can see it's quite magnificent. This dome, incidentally, is thought to have been constructed to match the Church of the Holy Sepulchre that already existed in that place. And if the Christians could do it, well, the Islamic architects could do better. Just look at the marvellous ceramic tile work that there is there. This is a vast area now that is given over, of course, to the control of the Muslims. If you were to walk around the perimeter of this site, and I know being Americans you would prefer to drive around the perimeter of this site, but if you were to walk around it, it would take you a mile to walk the entire outskirts of this temple area, vastly extended, remember, by Herod. It comprises now 37 acres, right in the middle of the city of Jerusalem. So it is a vast area, and a quite beautiful area in which to go. As Jews wouldn't go, if you wish to visit as a Christian, you have to be up there at the crack of dawn. I think they open the access way for Christians at about 7 o'clock, and you have to be off the site by about 11 o'clock. So for those few hours, you are allowed access to the area there on certain provisos and under careful supervision. You're not allowed to read the Bible up there or to offer prayers, but then who could say what you were doing when your eyes were closed? And you can't get access now into the noble sanctuary, the Dome of the Rock. You once were able to, but since there have been so many evangelical threats to blow it up, now only Islamic worshippers are allowed access there. And the same is true of the other mosque that exists, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is elsewhere on the site. Just look at the nature of the ceramic work there, the tile work. It is magnificent. This entire area was refurbished by the Jordanians in 1955, including the regilding of the dome itself. It said that if you were to go inside and if you could read the inscriptions that were there, then you'd probably be mortally offended as a Christian, because one of the inscriptions on the inside says that Allah is so magnificent that he could never beget a son, which goes to show that it's a polemic against Christianity, but it only goes to show that Allah doesn't know what he has missed, considering what has happened with Almighty God and his Son, the Lord Jesus Christ. It is a beautiful building, but at the same time it's an abomination, because it is sited in the very area where once the temple of God existed, back in the time of Solomon, later of course re-established by the exiles, beautified by Herod the Great. And somewhere on this site, and opinions vary, the temple was established. If you're conversant with the writings and drawings of Brother Lane Ritmier, who was an architect, an architectural draftsman on some of the excavation work that was done in Jerusalem, then you might know that he in fact thinks that there was a much smaller area before Herod extended it. And he thinks that it was along these lines. And he finds some support in this area here from this particular change in the nature of the paving work. This picture taken by his son shows as clearly as anything just where he thinks the actual original area came. And because the Islamic authorities have recently been putting in a spare generator, and one of his mates happened to be up on the mount, he noted that if you look carefully at this area here, you can in fact see that there is some ancient stonework, ashlars, that were there, just about this area here on the site. So we'd be looking in the first instance at that step that was there, and now at about this area here. And Brother Lane again draws some credence from the fact that he thinks that was the original site. A smaller site then, on which Solomon's temple was first constructed, enlarged by Herod the Great, but still not answering the question as to exactly where the temple was sited. Well, Brother Lane has an idea about that as well. Using a photograph, because he's been unable, of course, to gain access to this rock, he believes that, in fact, this area here is the very place where once the Ark of the Covenant reposed. If you've never read any of Lane's books, for example, his latest one is called The Quest, then this might come as news to you. But in fact, that's his suggestion, that once there, the wall came down this area here. He thinks that's part of the actual area, came across this side here and down in this area here, and that there the Ark of the Covenant reposed. And those of you who think that the Ark actually turned when it was brought in need to think again, because of the length of the poles. In all probability, it came in straight and stayed straight, which is not always how illustrators depict it. It may be, it may not be, but where God once established his holy name, the place of rest where he said he would dwell in the midst of his people, is no doubt the very place where again God purposes to plant his feet and to have his dwelling place once more constructed. Of course, you need to roll back the time to think about how it all looked back in the days of the Lord Jesus Christ, when Herod's temple existed. These are the colonnades that I was talking about earlier, when we looked at that one smooth stone. Brother Lane, again in his blog, he sends a pretty weekly blog out about any archaeological finds, suggests that it was one of the stones from these colonnades that later became engrafted into the western retaining wall itself. This is a model of first century Jerusalem that used to exist in the Holy Land Hotel, which has now been moved to the Israeli Museum, the Israel Museum. And it's a really quite fascinating model to walk around and to photograph. Back on the Temple Mount itself, there are some stones that are left lying around, which you might have thought the Jews would have tidied away by now. After all, they're a pretty tidy people, and moving a few stones like that would be no great effort for them. But they have Christian pilgrims in mind, because these are the stones that would once have been thrown down at the time of the Romans and have been left there deliberately. You remember the statement in Luke chapter 21, there shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. And those are the very stones that are still there. Once they existed as part of the Herodian structure up on that platform, now they've been thrown down, were thrown down in ancient days, and have been allowed to remain there as a testimony to the truth of the prophecy of the Lord Jesus Christ. People looked at the temple and said, what a marvelous structure it was. Jesus said, not one stone will remain upon another. All shall be thrown down. And interestingly enough, not only have they retained those, but there is a network of Roman sewers that exist under this. This is actually a Roman road at this level here. There was a brother in the party that I was visiting a couple of years ago who was standing in this area, and a manhole opened and a man came out of it. And he wasn't clearing the drains, he was an archaeologist. And Ray said to him, what have you found down there? He said, you'd be amazed. And it is quite amazing what is being discovered as they're now sifting through the subterranean parts of Jerusalem. As you move from those fallen stones and come to this area here, This is the Robinson Arch. Robinson was an American, just to encourage you there. And this is the arch that was named after him. And it's part, if you notice this abutment here, it's part of a bridge that once existed in this area to give access to the Herodian Temple Mount. And you can pretty well reconstruct that, the Robinson's Arch, Edward Robinson. And that's the reconstruction in the Israel Museum that shows the way in which worshippers would have come, as it were, by the side door, because there were several entrances here as well on the southern wall. But that now is the remaining part of that particular arch as it sprung. So you can begin to build on those little bits that have been left to see in your mind's eye just what the temple was like in the days of the Lord Jesus Christ. No doubt this was how Jesus once entered the temple and went there in the colonnades that were around, remember, where he was allowed to teach and to preach, and the people came to hear him. Just underneath that arch, there's something known as the Trumpet Stone, which in fact is a reconstruction, because the original is in the Israeli Museum, but it's known as the Stone of Trumpeting. And this again has been thrown down, as you can see, it's been broken and cast down. And it's been thrown down from the pinnacle of the temple. For the pinnacle of the temple would have been this area here, and the stone itself is to be found in this area here, if it wasn't for that stone wall in the way. So the pinnacle of the temple is the very spot from which the Lord Jesus once contemplated the possibility of throwing himself down so that the angels of God might catch him, before immediately quashing that idea and declaring that he would worship the Lord his God and not go in for sensational displays. It's known as the Trumpet Stone because this would have been the place where once the priests stood to trumpet in the new months, or to call Israel to worship at the various feasts. And it would have been in this area here that that stone was to be found, broken down and then thrown down to the southern wall of the temple. This is the area which is just below that area there, and you can see that these are Roman shops which have been excavated, and it was under here that the Roman drains have been investigated, where excavators have been down looking to see what they might find. And they found some very interesting things. Here's a seal, for example, of a man called Matanyahu, which means gift of God, not Netanyahu, Matanyahu. And you can see that that would have been a seal which you pressed into wax in order to leave your particular personal mark. And most remarkably of all, they have discovered a tiny golden pomegranate bell. If you search on the web, you can actually hear that bell being rung. And it's thought that this might have been one of the bells that was sewn onto the hem of the priestly robe, a bell and a pomegranate, remember, a bell and a pomegranate, sewn on the priestly robe, so that when the priest went in to offer incense or to worship in the temple, you knew he hadn't died because you could hear the bell still tinkling. Remarkable discovery found in the drainage system way down there. And that's by no means all. You see this area here, what appears to be a Nissen hut. Well, this is an area where the Jews have now been carefully sifting through a huge amount of debris. The Islamic authorities have been excavating quite ruthlessly on the Temple Mount and have been extending and enlarging their occupation, and have been doing so without archaeological supervision. They've just been digging away and dumping the spoil, and the Israelis have been sifting through the dumped spoil, and this is known as the wet sifting area, because they've now discovered that if you sift through a sieve but make it a wet sieve, then you find all manner of remarkable things. In fact, if you're a tourist or even a school child, you can go and join in this particular process. So you can go and see from a load of rubbish whether or not there's anything to be found in it. Here are school children obviously enjoying the prospect of getting their hands dirty, but in the process of so doing, all sorts of little things that would otherwise not have been found are in fact being discovered. In fact, it's being now suggested that sites like Megiddo, which were archaeologically investigated many years ago under different technology, should now be worked through. They should work through the spoil heaps of places like Megiddo to see just what there is that has been found there. Here are some of the things that have been discovered, courtesy of Biblical Archaeological magazine. There, for example, is an Egyptian scarab you can see the dates there, 1550 to 1200 BC, sometime during that period. Here's a seal, also known as a bulla, again from the 6th or 7th century BC. This is a Roman object, a votive offering of some sort, and this would have been an arrowhead, possibly a Babylonian arrowhead. So all of these are things that have come out of that sifting process. This is an interesting one, number 5 here in the catalogue. It is in fact the oldest Akkadian text that has ever been found. Now, until recently, there was a brother living in Birmingham who was a world expert on the reading of Akkadian. He was Emeritus Professor, Brother Wilfred Lambert, and he used to go down to the British Museum every Thursday to read some of these ancient tablets, and often found some interesting things. Here's an inscription which includes the words Gibeon for the king, thought to have come from the time of Manasseh. And this is a token, number 7 here, which would have been a token that declared a ritual offering pure for Yah. Remember the arrangement where you went with an animal that you might be wanting to offer at the temple? Well, it had to pass the temple authority's scrutiny, and it was only if it was acceptable that you would be allowed to proceed with your offering. If they found any blemish in it of any sort, well, they could sell you a better one at twice the price, and that was the one that you were allowed to offer. So notice that by the careful process of sifting, what is here being discovered is the whole past of the Jewish and Israeli occupation of the Temple Mount, and that's politically hugely sensitive, because in fact the Palestinians don't believe that there was ever a temple there, don't accept the earlier Jewish occupation, and want instead to make out that they have been in occupation of the land without Jewish interference for a long period of time. And remarkably recently, they discovered this item. Anybody like to offer what it might be? It's more than a nail, but you're in the right sort of area. It's neither a nail nor a stake, Richard. It's a chisel. It's a chisel that was used for the actual preparing of the stones. And again, not a huge one, but then bear in mind it will have rusted away quite considerably over the time. It's either a bronze or an iron chisel. And here's an interesting little artifact. Well, not so little. This is, well, does anybody know what this is? Sorry? It's an ossuary. That's quite right, George. An ossuary, for those of you who are not familiar with Jewish burial practice, is a box in which you put your bones once your body had, well, not your personal bones, but the bones of one of your relatives, once the body had disintegrated and was merely a skeleton. What you then did was break up the skeleton, pack it neatly in an ossuary, and then move the ossuary, it's a bone box in other words, and put it away. And what's special about this particular ossuary, George, do you know? This is the ossuary that has been the source of huge controversy with the Israeli authorities. The declaration on it, the statement here, said that this was the son of Joseph, the brother of Jesus. And the Israeli authorities took exception to the fact that this ossuary might be genuine. It belonged to a man called Oded Golan. Oded Golan is an archaeology dealer in a small way. He actually had it in his toilet area for quite a long time. But then he was prevailed upon to send it to Canada in the first instance for display in one of their museums. They broke it on the way there, and then it was fixed. But when it returned to Israel, it was impounded, and he was charged as a forger. And for 8 years, this went through the Israeli courts, alleging that he had forged this inscription. And all sorts of investigation took place into this lettering, first of all by handwriting experts, and then particularly to examine the patina on the inscription itself, you know, because as things age, then dirt accrues and things develop within the lettering, and it was suggested that in fact he had forged the bit that said brother of Jesus. It was merely son of Joseph. And after 8 years of careful consideration, where experts were dragged in from all the world, he was declared to not have forged it, and the artifact was declared genuine. And then the Israeli authorities wouldn't hand it over because they thought that they should keep possession of it. So again, another court case began. I think he's got it back now. And Herschel Shanks, who's the editor of the Biblical Archaeological Review, took huge interest in this particular process and kept his readers well informed. Oded Golan also found another artifact, which is quite fascinating, known as the Joash Tablet. Now again, nobody quite knows where he found it from. It's thought that it might have come out of the temple spoils, but this is a declaration by King Joash, which would be back in 2 Kings chapter 12, where Joash repaired the temple. You remember that situation where the priests were hanging about, and although money had been collected, they hadn't improved the temple. And then the king said, well, ask for the priestly levy. And they said, no, they couldn't do that because, well, you know, their standing wasn't that good with the people. And so eventually he said, well, have a box and wait for the offerings to come in. And eventually those offerings came in and the work was done. Well, this actually declares that process of improvement for the temple. And when you examine it very carefully, there are flecks of gold actually embedded in the inscription, which seems to suggest that when eventually the temple was destroyed by the Romans, the gold of the temple was somehow or other deeply embedded. Flecks of that gold were embedded in this tablet. And the tablet probably lay uncared for and undiscovered for many years until it came into Oded Golan's hands. Well, there have been lots of investigations then on and about the Temple Mount. We've been looking in the area there of the Yellow Arrow. This was where the trumpet stone was to be found. It was in this area here that we looked at the seal that had been found and the little pomegranate bell that had been discovered. But if we move to this area here, we move to a part of Jerusalem known as the Ophel for archaeological purposes, and to the work that's being done by Dr. Eilat Matzar, who is Benjamin Matzar's granddaughter. And those of you who are familiar at all with the biblical archaeology will know that Benjamin Matzar was the archaeologist of, for example, Masada. He was the key responsible for that work, and his granddaughter is following in his footsteps and has made, to her own satisfaction at least, some remarkable discoveries in this particular area. Now, I should tell you that a lot of these discoveries are controversial in the sense that academics then say, well, they're not so sure, but she remains convinced that what she has found is actually absolutely genuine. And she is one of these archaeologists, which unfortunately is now a rare breed, who look for things that support the authority of the Bible. There's a huge argument about whether you should look at the Bible at all or whether you should simply look at the soil. And there are an awful lot of archaeologists around known as minimalists who are trying to suppress and compress the history of the Jewish past. We're in this area here now. So that the temple, as it would have existed once in Herod's time, these would have been the access areas. This would have been the bridge that allowed you access from the Robinson's Arch. And that would have been across the Wilson Arch that we were looking at before. But in this area here, well, what has she discovered? She has discovered the oldest inscription that has been found in Jerusalem. Just 8 letters. And nobody's entirely sure what those old letters actually amount to. This is what appears to have been a wine jar or pitcher. And this inscription has been found on it, which is thought to go back to something like the 10th century. That's a remarkable discovery in itself. But she then discovered a real treasure haul. This is a menorah amulet, which in fact is a Byzantine remnant. It was found in a little stash of things which contained other jewellery and other coins. If you notice there, there's a shofar and there's a Torah scroll, and this is a menorah or a candlestick. And that seems to have been part of an offering that Byzantine worshippers were bringing, perhaps to support some enlargement or development of the then temple area. And for some reason or other, they had to hide their loot, and it remained undiscovered until it was dug up recently. Notice the shofar is the Jubilee trumpet, of course. Now let's move a little to the south of the area, to the city of David. We've been looking at this area here, where Elatmazar was digging. Well, she's also been working in this area here, which is the top of the city of David. This broken white line shows the extent of the city of David and reminds you, incidentally, of how small that city actually was. And it was Solomon, remember, who bridged the Ophel and who built the temple upon this area here. Although, as we were seeing, a rather reduced part of that temple mount from what Herod later expanded. So what has she found in this area here, the area of the yellow arrow? Well, to her satisfaction, she thinks that she has discovered where the palace of King David and the kings of Israel, before Solomon extended and moved them up onto the Mount Moriah area, was in fact established. Where the Jebusites first had their citadel, where David himself would have been living and ruling. And those of you who might have walked this particular area will know that the terrain falls quite steeply down, so that if you were in that area there and looking down over the city, you'd have a pretty good view of the housetops, and it would be well to look away when certain ladies were bathing. Well, what has she discovered in this area here as she's moved down to the yellow area? Well, she thinks she has discovered the Palace of David. Again, there's a lot of controversy about this amongst other archaeologists who dispute it, but they certainly accept that she has found a huge stone structure, and she's been digging carefully with a lot of assistance and sponsor support in this particular area. Interestingly enough, she's been helped by some Americans who've come from the Herbert Armstrong College, and they've been journeying over there to enjoy some digging, and apparently have been meticulous and useful workers. Herbert Armstrong, you might remember, was the author of the Plain Truth magazine. He's long since expired now, but obviously the colleges that he established are still going strong. And this is the sort of stonework that she's found. And amongst this stonework, she's found some quite fascinating things. She's found, for example, copper scrolls. She's also found bulla, or seals. In one instance, she found two seals of a man called Gedaliah and another man whose name escapes me for the moment, both of whom are found in Jeremiah chapter 38, both of whom were court officials who were responsible for having Jeremiah put into that cistern where he sank almost without trace if it hadn't been a rescue process. So to find those actual statements there, as well as, of course, pottery associated with the right time, is just an indication that she may well be on the right track here. So that you can see that the work that she's doing, she believes then that that was where the palace of David once stood. And you'll notice there the stepped area that supports it, the abutment there that secures it as the topography drops away into the valley alongside. Fascinatingly, when Brother Lane Ritmere some years ago suggested that David's palace had been built here, and that in fact David planted a tent or erected a tent in which the Ark of the Covenant might repose before the temple was built by Solomon, he built it or he constructed it rather in his mind's eye, just by this stepped stone structure, a structure which appears to be Jebusite in its origin, and which would have been used there to make sure that the palace and whatever there was built upon those walls didn't slip into the valley. You can still see that stepped stone structure, and that's probably what it looked like. There's the stepped stone structure in that area there, and that's where the temple was later constructed. But the palace itself would have been in that area, and this is a much better idea of how tightly packed all the buildings would have been in what was really a comparatively small area. And in this stepped stone area, they've actually discovered at the house of a man called Ahiel. They know it was Ahiel because they found something that identified it as his house. And there would be the house in question. And just to give you a view of that from one or two different perspectives, there's the house. And there's no privacy at all, is there? You look at his house from every direction. And you can see it was constructed there, and sad to say, that's even his toilet that is now on display. So that Ahiel, if he was alive and well, would be thinking, well, this is too unreasonable. If you do go on a tour visit, and you would be diverted around this stepped stone structure before going into the water shafts that exist in this particular area. The Gihon Spring was a lifeline for Jerusalem, and this was a water supply that had to be secured. And there would have been ways of accessing that water without obviously going outside the walls and round with your bucket or your skin. And some of those water courses are very, very tricky to navigate. And again, nobody knows for certain, but it was up one of these water courses that Joab climbed when, you'll remember, David put his job on the line when Joab was obviously a problem to David, and David, having conquered, or rather wanting to conquer Jerusalem from the Jebusites, said, whoever is able to get up the gutter or the water course and to conquer these Jebusites, well, he'll be my commander in chief. So in fact, if anybody other than Joab had done it, Joab would have become redundant. Well, who was it who went? It was Joab, of course, who climbed up with his spear. It was Joab who opened the gates. It was Joab who released the Israeli army into the city so that they might conquer it. And it would have been a dangerous thing for him to do, but then he was that sort of a man. What the archaeologists are now doing, and you'll notice these RSJs and concrete beams across here, because these are Arab houses built on the city of David, they're actually securing those houses to their own satisfaction and busily excavating to try and find out what was going on in the lower stratas, in the underground part of Jerusalem. The spring itself had to be fortified. It was no good leaving a watercourse outside the city, because then the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Persians, or whoever else was to come down would have had water to their own satisfaction and could easily have poisoned the water supply of the city, so that it looks as though the Gihon String was in fact fortified. This is a picture that the archaeologists themselves have pinned up on the wall by that particular excavation to suggest what they think they are finding. That in fact the walls themselves had been brought out to secure the spring, and of course for defensive purposes. And so it became possible for the Israelis to draw that water out. And of course, Hezekiah made particular provisions in that respect, known as Hezekiah's Tunnel, and again, discovered by an American, by Robinson, back in the 1930s. This is something that you can now wade through and have great fun in doing so. It was probably enlarged by Hezekiah's men at the time of the impending Assyrian invasion. I say that because when you first step into the water, and incidentally it comes way up into your thighs when you step off this area here and plunge into it, and later on it comes down to below your knees so that gradually it diminishes, but the first jump in is the most exciting one. You can see the actual size of that cavern, much bigger than you would simply build if you were just wanting somewhere where you could go and draw water. because, of course, there's the idea that you could draw it. But later on, as you walk through, it suddenly becomes much, much lower, which suggests that they had earlier made an attempt to, in some way or other, regulate or control the Gihon spring. And later on, when the pressure was on, they minimized their digging and reduced the size of the actual cavern structure. So that by the time you actually emerge, well, it's a much more manageable area. Way back when all this was being debated in the Palestine exploratory literature, Brother Sully, who wrote, of course, his book on the temple, actually wrote to the Palestinian Exploration magazine to suggest that maybe there had been an original stream down this particular area and they followed the stream. And there may have been some truth in that. There are some archaeologists who still believe that to this day. You notice how small it has got as you proceed down there, and how more economical they are. But I'm sure you're aware of the fact that they in fact discovered this Siloa inscription, which is now in a museum in Istanbul, which says that two groups of people were digging from two different areas, and that eventually they heard the sound of the other digging party and were able to join up, and then to make it a thorough way, a through way. In fact, they meandered somewhat. When you're walking through that tunnel, you'll notice there are one or two cul-de-sacs where they'd gone offline, and nobody really understands quite how they were able to meet together to one another. This tunnel is a third of a mile long, so it's a considerable construction, but fortunately they did meet up, and there's the inscription that tells the tale. You emerge into what used to be thought the Pool of Siloam. In fact, it's now understood to have been a development of what was once there, the Upper Pool of Siloam, thought to have been developed in the 5th century AD. And now, this is where they direct you to the Lower Pool of Siloam, which is thought to have been the original one. And you might notice that at the time we were there a couple of years ago, not much development had occurred in this area here. But notice the step down. Well, by now, they've begun that process of excavation. It all came to light when they were putting this sewer in for the Jerusalem city. This is the water of the Gihon spring here. So that's the water that you would have been paddling through as you careered through Hezekiah's tunnel. And this was the area where you were then allowed to walk. Well, now notice that they have worked their way down step by step by step. This land here is an orchard belonging, I think, to a Catholic institution. And unfortunately, in Jerusalem and in Israel in general, if you happen to have ownership of land which has an archaeological treasure on it, you have to pay for the excavation. So understandably, the excavation is stopping at that particular point because the landowners abutting it think, well, enough is enough, and they don't want to cough up for what would obviously be a substantial amount of work. But you'll notice that if you were going to come to this particular pool, and it looks as though it was a mikveh, a place for ceremonial washing, then in fact you would be walking down step by step by step by step by step until at last you hit the water. Here's an artist's reconstruction of it, which is how it might have been, which gives you that sense. Remember, the Jews were very careful about ceremonial washing, and therefore quite understood. If you wanted to become a proselyte, for example, being a Gentile, you wished to become a Jew, then you had to be bathed in a mikveh, and the rabbi said that you would come up and your skin would be like that of a newborn babe. Brother Lane Ritmier has a slightly different take on that, and in fact suggests that that's how it might have looked. Perhaps there would have been a construction around it. But it has also been discovered that going alongside that mikveh, there is a staircase that leads right up. This is how the Jews have depicted it. Again, on the wall in that particular area, because, well, Jerusalem's a small place. You use every bit of real estate. There would doubtless have been houses or shops right abutting those steps. And those steps would have led right up to the temple area itself. Might be hilly, might be steep, but there would have been a staircase that took you all the way up to the temple. That's the very staircase down which the blind man would have come, daubed as he was with clay and spittle, when the Lord had sent him to the Pool of Siloam. Pool of Siloam, remember, means sent. And what does he say? I went, I washed, I came seeing. He would have been sent down this particular staircase. And it's remarkable to be able to walk along that staircase and incidentally to notice that it's not always in excellent repair. Notice this hole in that very staircase? This is because the drainage tunnel that ran underneath that staircase was hacked through by the Romans back in AD 70 when they were in pursuit of those pesky Jews that had given them so much trouble. And the Jews went and hid in these drainage areas, in the cisterns, in this part of the underground Jerusalem. And you can now stand on that very area and see that this is where the Jewish zealots had fled, and the Romans fled after them, pursuing them. They went down all the drainways, all the narrow gutters, everywhere that they could find, and steadily they eliminated all that were left of the rebels that had stood against them. Here's Josephus' comment, but although they had this commiseration for such as were destroyed in that manner, yet had they not the same for those that were still alive, but they ran everyone through whom they met with, and obstructed the very lanes with their dead bodies, and made the whole city run down with blood, to such a degree indeed that the fire of many of the houses was quenched with these men's blood. Gives you a little insight, doesn't it, to what AD 70 was like, when at last the Romans wreaked their revenge upon those who had stood against them. So there we go. We've been looking at the past in Jerusalem, and notice that everything that has been found supports and establishes the historicity of the Bible, its authenticity, and the fact that, of course, the Jews were there, that a temple was built, that there were people living there right through the pages of the scriptures, whether the Jewish authorities wished to accept it or not. This was the very place where once the Lord Jesus lived. It was in these temple areas that he taught. These were the very people who conspired against him and had him crucified. And yet, of course, our hope is not for the continuance or preservation of Jerusalem as it is, but for the transformation of the city, for the removal of the noble sanctuary, beautiful though it is, and its replacement with the temple of the living God, for the time when all nations will come here to worship, and when at last God will be glorified in all his ways. There is a river there that will flow from that very city to enlighten and to satisfy all the thirst of all the nations of the world. No wonder it was that Jeremiah said, "Let Jerusalem come into your minds."